Laurie and I have been coming to the San Cruz Zen Center for the last few years in a very welcoming community, and been doing a book study with Kokio and members of the community here, and thought, wouldn't it be interesting for our Sangha Shanti Vanam, which meets a couple times a month, with Father Cyprian, who's friends with Kokio, if the two of them got together and a topic that the Buddha and Jesus would speak about so clearly and beautifully. And so we thought the topic of suffering and emptiness might take us through the evening and some. So what we're going to do is ask Father Cyprian to speak for, 10 minutes or so, if he could barely do that, and Kokio as well, and then really have them ask each other questions, to witness and watch just a Buddhist and a Christian talk about these topics, and then we'll open it up for our questions at about 7:30. So hold your questions, let them speak, let them talk to each other, and hold your questions till 7:30.
What do you think?
In that case, I guess I could go back.
Would you?
For sure.
Please. Can you all hear in back there?
We only exchanged a couple of emails about this and then talked for about 30 seconds out there, so this really is rather on the impromptu side. But I asked if we could talk about emptiness first. From my own understanding of the Buddhist teaching about shunyata, specifically through Dogen, again, probably a dilettante study compared to Kokyo, obviously. And I wanted to use this example. A friend of mine and I, who is another musician, we're out with a third friend of ours who's also a musician. And this first friend and I were arguing about this musician. I don't remember his name right now, but I'm going to use the name Trevor Thompson. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about Trevor Thompson. I mentioned something about his new album. I thought it was so wonderful. And my friend said, "Are you kidding? I can't stand it." We went back and forth about this until we got angry at each other. And we were practically yelling at each other in this restaurant about Trevor Thompson. And the third guy, who was actually paying for the meal, at one point said, "You're talking about two different people with the same name." So that kind of ended the discussion and ended the meal as well. And we left shortly after that. And in some way, I thought it was very interesting. From my understanding of shunyata, from the Sanskrit through the Japanese tradition, is translated as emptiness, generally. And we use the word emptiness, the most popular, famous way is from the letter to the Philippians. St. Paul's letter to the Philippians talks about Jesus, though he was in the form of God, did not deem equality with God, but rather he emptied himself. And the Greek word is kenosis. And kenosis means emptiness. But it doesn't mean, I don't think it means the same emptiness as the Buddhist emptiness. And I'm sure we could find resonances, but I think it means a different thing. But the different thing it means, I think, is actually very telling about our own poetry, of our mysticism from the two different traditions. And the word kenosis, as it's used in that context, in the kind of fusty old theological way, would talk about imagining Jesus as pre-existing before the person of the flesh and blood person of Jesus on earth, as the Logos, the Word, the Christ, the Divine One, who condescends to come to earth, and so empties self of divinity in order to be a human being. That's the older definition of it. And I think it might have something to do with, anybody knows about this Jewish notion of God pulling back and withdrawing so the world can exist. It's a very beautiful thing. You remember I was hearing about that in Jerusalem. God pulls back so that the world can exist. It's something like that of the divine logos emptying self to be human, not being divine anymore, so to bring human beings to divinity. That's one way of looking at it. But there's another way, because Paul introduces it by saying, you should have the same mind as Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not deem equality with God something to be grasped at, but rather emptied himself, took the form of a slave. Which kind of turns it around a little bit, because now you're starting with the humanity rather than the divinity.
Sounds almost opposite.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's the human person, Jesus, emptying himself of clinging to any kind of self, in a sense, so as to be filled with divinity. Because later Paul will say two or three times, my favorite definition of who we think Jesus is as the Christ, that the fullness of divinity dwelled in him bodily. And that's because he was empty. And so could be filled with divinity. So that's the kind of emptiness that I'm really attracted to. First of all, I don't know that it means the same as shunyata in the philosophical sense. But then we get to, for example, I'm from the Camaldolese Benedictine tradition, and we have a very brief monastic rule, about a paragraph long, which I think is very interesting. It starts with the word sit, and it ends with the word sit. It starts out with sit in your cell as if in paradise. And then it ends with this beautiful phrase, empty yourself completely, and sit waiting. So kenosis means that to me. We're emptying ourself. And our friend Gitanjali wrote this beautiful kind of a bhajan for us to sing, empty yourself of yourself. So as to be, I don't know, maybe it's too active to say as to be filled with something else, but we would definitely use that word, empty. And I like to say in my own kind of homiletic way, empty of ourselves of everything that's not godly. And quite often it's the things that we're clinging to. And here I think we're in some kind of similar vocabulary. Mm-hmm. Can I start with that and pass it
sure.
to you?
Sure. Well, the second type of emptiness there sounds very similar, mm-hmm. I would say, to the Buddhist notion of shunyata. Sometimes we say shunyata or emptiness is the, we were saying, well, what are we, empty of what? So the most classic definition is empty of independent existence. And it refers to not just people and living beings, but everything, all phenomena in the world and their true real nature are empty of existing independently, meaning like in and of themselves, because everything can only exist interdependently, both living beings and inanimate phenomena. Everything arises interdependently, dependent on other conditions, and therefore it's a emptiness generally refers to empty of independent existence. So in some traditions, they speak of these two terms, self-emptiness and other emptiness. In Zen, we don't often get into this distinction, but I think it might help to apply here. Self-empty, or empty of self, is the kind of classic thing, is things are empty of themselves, means they don't exist in and of themselves. They have no essence. A chair doesn't exist apart from its parts, for example, like the back and the seat and the legs and the name, chair. It depends on all these things. So it depends on a sentient being to call it a chair and recognize it as a particular thing. And there's not like there's chairs. If there's no minds in the universe, there aren't any chairs. It takes living beings with minds to basically create chairs. So that's empty, everything is empty of itself. But then there's this other term, other emptiness, or other emptiness, that there's some debate within some of these traditions about which is more accurate, self-emptiness or other emptiness. And the other emptiness people say that it's referring particularly to mind and to living beings and Buddha nature. And we say that Buddha nature, which is like the empty, clear awareness that is our true nature, it's actually not empty of itself, but it's empty of everything other than itself. And that which is other than itself is like greed, hate, and delusion. Or maybe like we'd say, whatever's not in the realm of God or the holy.
Could you say that again, like, back up one sentence?
Yeah. Empty of other means that Buddha nature, our true nature, is not empty of itself. I think that this they were pointing towards the fact that we don't want to negate this pure, undefiled awareness called Buddha nature or awakened nature. We don't say that that doesn't exist, but we say that everything other than that doesn't really exist. So there's only this pure, compassionate, open, loving, selfless nature is who we truly are. And that is empty of all the distortions, like the belief that we're separate and dualistic thinking and so on. Can you follow that? Difference between self-emptiness, which is like everything's empty of itself, so that you really can't say there's anything at all. And other emptiness is pointing towards the fact that there's something that's not empty, which is this inconceivable Buddha nature. It's not a thing, actually, but we say we be careful not to negate it.
And would you opt on the empty, the other empty side instead of the self-empty side?
Yeah, I think there's virtues to both, to looking at both. But yeah, if I had to say, well, there's one kind of school that seems more accurate than the other, yeah, the empty of other side. And interestingly, the more contemplative, meditative traditions veer towards this other emptiness side.
Oh,
because they say, well, how can you negate this, this awareness? Whereas the more kind of just scholastic, philosophical debate traditions say, well, you really have to negate everything. You can't leave anything unnegated. So those are sometimes the self-empty folks.
See, now I find that to be really good news, because the deeper I was digging into this, the more I just keep butting up against anatta.
Yeah.
Anatta. Mm-hmm. No self,
yep.
No self. Like that,
negation.
That step beyond Paratman of Hinduism, mm-hmm. into there's no self of the mm-hmm. divine, there's no self of self. Even the self that you experience, I had this long discussion over the phone with them, I'm sure, about this.
Yeah.
Even the self that you experience is made up of skandhas and heaps of impermanent things that's constantly, there's no,
yep.
like somehow get rid of that whole essential argument.
Mm-hmm.
There's only phenomena, there's only the jobusho of turning around and around. And somehow this is what bumps right into the notion of suffering. That's why I can't talk about the two separately. Because in a sense, whatever is crossed over beyond this small self, I don't want to use that word, beyond this phenomenal self, the egoic self, the persona self, where I think we do agree is there's something beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
We get into real subtle territory when we start talking, using our different poetry about what that thing is. But this foundational myth for the Christian tradition, and I mean myth in the gentlest sense of the word, a story that's trying to convey a truth, this essential myth of us is the resurrection. that something survived annihilation, whatever that was. I mean, even if I don't understand it, even if I don't agree with it, even if I don't believe it, I can't get around that. That's like, that's right at the core of Christianity. And there's a mystical intuition there that something did survived annihilation. Mm-hmm. Something pure and beautiful and wonderful. And what does that mean? That's why suffering is a part of this to me. It's the bridge. Mm.
How's the, what's this connection to suffering?
Are you ready to go to suffering?
Sure, we can leave it again.
Well, again, just because I'm a nerd, I like to play with words. And really the first meaning of suffer does not necessarily have pain involved in it. Does not necessarily mean a negative thing. The first meaning of suffering is actually to endure or to allow. So even, you know, the King James Version of the Bible, Jesus says, suffer the little children to come to me. Allow them to come to me. It's only the intransitive, for us language people, the intransitive form of it that has a negative connotation to it. And somehow I think that quite out of our, I don't know if I want to use the word sin or if I want to use the word unrighteous behavior, unhealthy behavior, has to do with avoiding pain and augmenting pleasure. And no matter what you would call it from your tradition, so many of the precepts are about staying with the pain and not trying to augment the pleasure so much. Because those are the things that are actually passing. But there's something that has to be suffered in the sense of endured in order to get beyond this phenomenal self.
Yes.
And maybe it just means that my ankle is going to hurt in the morning because I sat for 45 minutes in half lotus. I mean, there's a suffering and a pain that has to be gone through. But the, I know it's a very crass word to talk about a reward, but there's something beyond on the other side of that that I'm not going to experience it unless I actually suffer something. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then I think when we're talking about the basic phenomena of life, even somehow the sickness, old age, and death of the Buddha, they're all things that have to be suffered in the first sense of the word, have to be endured and allowed and even accepted. And in accepting them, I'm not attaching to them. Even they're like clouds passing by. Now, maybe they're very mean, angry, dark clouds full of rain and hail and lightning, but they also, they're impermanent. And they have to be, or we good if they would, if they could be suffered in that sense.
Interesting. Yes.
Totally wrong. Very interesting.
I see in a lot of these discussions, it's a lot about words and how we use language, and we're in both traditions, we're building on languages other than English, right? So it's going through translation. So first, just to back up a little bit about the emptiness part, and how you were saying, yeah, in like Hinduism they have the great Atman, the great self, and Buddhism is known for more like the really negating the Anatman. But in the Mahayana, this great vehicle, kind of later Indian Buddhism, of which Zen is a part, there is some emphasis on, like, for example, Buddha nature, and which is Buddha nature is closely connected with this other emptiness tradition. It means like there is something, and I think that very similar to the Hindu tradition with this Atman, it's not something that you can get a hold of. This Atman is right, inconceivable true nature of every person. So there's something there, but we can't say what it is. We can't actually, like, we're living in it all the time, but we can't, like, pinpoint it. So I think that's something similar, and we maybe we can even venture into how God might even come in there. I'll let you think about that one. There's something similar there.
Yeah.
To the inconceivable something that's moving through us. But then just to get into suffering a little bit, because what Cyprian was saying about suffering in that case sounds kind of like we would call patience, or kshanti in the Buddhist tradition of patient endurance. And then there's this other term, dukkha, which is usually translated as suffering, but I like to say discontent. Some people even translate it as stress. And this is the kind that's like, there's not so much virtue in it. It's just, it's something that we actually want to get over. And so when we're talking about this dukkha, which the etymology of dukkha is apparently something like a wheel, like a cart wheel, with where the axle is out of center or it's loose, so it's wobbly. It doesn't roll quite right. It doesn't roll smoothly. That's like this, things aren't quite working right. That's why discontent is, I think, a nice one. And that the Buddha said, I only teach two things, suffering and the end of suffering. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about this one. I teach discontent, dukkha, and the end of discontent. Mm-hmm. And all the rest is footnotes to that. So so in that way, suffering is a really pivotal, essential topic in Buddhism. This type of suffering. And it's defined as the classic list of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, despair, not getting what we want, getting what we don't want, being apart from those we love, being with those we don't love, and so on. Even the Buddha's first teaching, he kind of laid this out and defined suffering, and then he said, in brief, you know, what is it actually? He said, defining it most accurately, this suffering, this dukkha, is grasping our body and mind experience as me and mine. That's one way to put it. As a small self. So identification with the small ego self is the basic definition of suffering. So that's in these early foundational teachings, but I want to also mention suffering in the Mahayana, again, is this movement towards like a vaster, more compassionate emphasis. The Bodhisattva vehicle, that living for the benefit of all beings, as opposed to these earlier teachings were more about self-liberation. So the Mahayana movement is towards like, we can't be free until everybody's free from discontent. And there's a wonderful teaching that's kind of surprising, I think, given the emphasis on ending suffering. And I think there's a different word here, and I couldn't find the Sanskrit equivalent. But there's a teaching of this 4th century Bodhisattva teacher, Asanga, in India, very important teacher. And he says that something like the Bodhisattva's suffering with others, in other words, like a kind of altruistic suffering or compassionate suffering. It's a little different kind of suffering, but the word is suffering in the English translation. That suffering of the Bodhisattva is greater than any worldly happiness or joy. So it really turns the whole Buddhist project of ending suffering kind of upside down in this Bodhisattva vehicle. The greatest joy and happiness of the Bodhisattva is to suffer with others. We're called compassion. And as Cyprian said also, this, if we look at suffering as this kind of endurance, of course we have this patience practice in Buddhism. We're willing to give up some of our own happiness for greater good for both ourselves and others. So I think in general it's like, it has to do with whether it's a kind of a small, self-centered, grasping kind of the suffering that comes from that versus the suffering that comes from maybe like really serving others selflessly.
Yeah, and we would call that redemptive suffering. Yeah, and like the suffering a parent goes through for a child. But that actually is ultimately the meaning of Jesus on the cross. It's the redemptive suffering. I mean, in a sense,
for others.
Yeah. And we add a whole lot of myth language on that in terms of sacrifice and appeasement and atonement. But in a sense, you could look at that as a human being making the trip across death for the sake of all living beings, to show that death might hurt a little bit, but it won't kill you. Like, there's something about me that's so secure that I cannot be annihilated even by everything being destroyed, which is really amazing. And you know, Jesus on the cross cries out, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, in Hebrew, my God, why have you abandoned me? Which actually leads us to that first thing you mentioned there, this inconceivable. From my experience, one of the greatest gifts that Christian monks, for instance, I'll speak from that tradition, receive mainly, I think, from Mahayana Buddhism, and my experience is mostly with Japanese Zen, and also from Taoism, is another language for what we call the via negativa, for the dark way, which we practice more than I think is ordinary Catholicism, ordinary Christianity, and probably specifically in like Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox, Roman Catholicism, a bit in Anglicanism, but outside of that, not practiced very much. We call it sometimes the apophatic tradition, that the journey to God is not a journey to more and more light, it's a journey into more and more darkness. That the closer we get, the more these words make no sense whatsoever. So Meister Eckhart gets in trouble for by saying something like that. You know, you could say, he says something like, you say God is light, but you're a liar. I'm light, but God is so far beyond what light is that to use the word light is... So we have that language. It's very hidden, I think, in the Christian tradition. It's mostly in the contemplative and monastic. But one of the great gifts of specifically Zen Buddhism and Taoism to me has been a new language for this, to make sense of this inconceivability of that absolute reality that we call God. And even that word somehow can be very confining because it's been so misused. You know, I was trying not to use the word God anymore because it's just quack, quack, quack. It has so many mirrors and bells and whistles on it that have nothing to do with the reality of what God is. And also the sense that we have a tendency to think of God as a being. And if you just drop the word a out, no, really, what Christianity teaches is God is being itself. And now I think we're darn close to Buddha nature, in the way you're talking about at least. God is not a being, like a big man, or even a big woman. God is being itself. And so then the ground of being, the source of being, and we be because we share in that being. And now we're darn close to dependent co-arising.
Yeah. And could you say being beyond all our ideas of being?
Absolutely. And this is the problem we get caught up. I think all of life is kind of a language event for most of us thinkers. But we have to realize that all of our language is like, you know, I think a French poet says something like, toy bears banging on cracked drums. So at some point you have to realize, have the humility to realize none of this language gets anywhere near it. And that's, of course, I mean, you and I are both from a contemplative tradition, why the experience is much more important than the words. And then we're trying to make sense of that experience. But it all winds up just being kind of fun poetry.
The cloud of unknowing.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And we have to leave all the concepts behind, too. But one more little image. Do you know, we had these beautiful discussions about the crucifix at one point with our Sangha for some of our members who were not Christian and don't necessarily understand what's this image of. But you know, Father Raniero and I were in Ravenna together, and we saw this incredible exhibit of the crucifix before St. Francis of Assisi. St. Francis really tried to accent the humanity of Christ more. So the suffering Christ on the cross came out much more after the 12th and 13th century. So here's this beautiful, we both fell in love with this crucifix of Jesus in priestly robes with a crown on his head, with a slight smile on his face on the cross. So suffering in the first sense of enduring, but not suffering in the second sense. So there he is as priest and royalty triumphing over death. And that, I love that. It's not to deny the reality of, you know, torn flesh and humiliation, but to say that there's suffering in the first sense, but not in that second sense. Is it a hint that there's Jesus triumphing on the cross instead?
Yeah, to add to that, almost like different aspects of suffering. So the Buddha, you know, had a limited lifespan, as did Christ. You know, Buddha lived for 80 earth years, right? Like regular people, and seemed to die. And he was apparently, there was physical discomfort at the end of his life. He had various sicknesses. But through his training, he could endure, and actually, his realization of Buddhahood many years before he died, right, was actually the end of suffering. And the way it's usually presented in the tradition is, he really did, like, all suffering was ended. And they would say, well, what about his sickness and so on? And they say, well, I think this is where we say there's a different kind of suffering. It's like, it's because he's in touch with this larger Buddha nature, it's okay and very natural to get sick and die. But also another name for the Buddha's enlightenment that he called himself, he had various names for, you know, nirvana, enlightenment. One of them is the deathless. He had realized the deathless. And that was actually, he set out on his quest. He's like, this seems like a big problem, this death thing. Right? I don't want to have to, like, how can we avoid this? It seems like it's a big problem. But his realization was that actually we don't die. We're not actually born either. We appear to die, or there's something, there's a body that's born and dies. But this may be similar to the resurrection too, is there's something larger that transcends death. The deathless. Amata, I think maybe this is a Sanskrit term. Even though it looks like there's a body that dies.
And you know what, this is getting somewhat into the more esoteric, but both in the Hindu and Buddhist tradition, and I've heard this more from from Buddhist monks, this idea of actually the body transforming of some of the great masters.
Yes.
In the Tibetan tradition and the Korean tradition, I know. And that's kind of phenomenal.
The relics.
My Korean Buddhist monk friend told me about, you know, his master dying, and they came the next day and there were just diamonds, you know, or something like jewels on the thing. And then the Tibetan, the rainbow body, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty fascinating. That somehow, it's somehow, that's to me the ultimate non-duality. Is to say that everything is transformed by this experience. That's what, to me, that's real non-duality. And I think that the resurrection is pointing to that. Is that it, matter is even somehow being transformed in some amazing, amazing way.
Yeah.
That we have these incredible laws of nature, but even those are petty compared to this mystery of absolute reality. I think Aurobindo himself thought he wasn't going to die. He thought his body would just be transformed. Mm. And his disciples say he chose to die at some point of kidney failure.
Yes. Another way to say it that ties into the emptiness part is we say empty of existing independently. Another way to say it is everything is empty of all our ideas of it. So... And even the most basic things, like this body, is really not what we think it is. We say, well, at least physical material world, can't we rely on that? Well, actually, according to these deepest teachings, it's like, that's a mental projection too. It's, if there is something here, it's not what we think it is. So, the most transcendent is, the body that we think is sitting here is not our true body.
But also I'm not a scientist at all, but hasn't modern science bumped right into that?
No, I think so.
In quantum physics
bumped
right into that. Mm-hmm.
We're very limited by our usual concepts as we've evolved as humans. We construct the world in very similar ways, and we agree that that's how things are, but it's quite limited.
Can I? We probably better open it up to them. Oh. But I mean, just one point that you mentioned, something about the Buddha having some physical discomfort at the end of his life. But I'm not sure where I read it. It might have been in Thich Nhat Hanh's book about the Buddha even being sad at the end of his life about the loss of his friends. Mm. And I don't know if it's a story about him or another Zen master. His student saw him weeping over a friend's loss. And the student was so discouraged by that. Yeah. And the master said, the answer was something like, if only he knew this passes too. Mm-hmm. It's okay to have emotions, mm-hmm. It's yes. not just...
Yeah, yeah.
It's not that. It's somehow to not hold on even to the sadness. Mm-hmm. To let it pass.
Yeah. Because it's all not what we think it is. Yeah. Therefore, we can let it all happen.
Yeah. We can just let it happen. Mm-hmm.
There's a story of D.T. Suzuki, who's a kind of contemporary Zen practitioner, wrote a lot of early Zen books translated into English in the 50s. And I heard the story that at one point his wife died, and he was considered a realized practitioner, and he was crying naturally, right? And somebody said, well, if you really understand that it's all empty... why are you crying? And he said, my tears have no roots. So I thought that was a beautiful line. We still cry, but I know these tears aren't what I think they are. But that doesn't mean we stop crying.
And really the same thing with happiness.
Yeah, yes.
It's a wonderful thing and then let it go. Because mm-hmm. If we try to avoid pain or augment pleasure, that's when we start getting in trouble.
Yeah. In fact, one more note about dukkha, this type of suffering. Buddha was into all these lists, right? So the three types of dukkha, three types of discontent. One of them is the discontent of discontent. The suffering of suffering, called dukkha, which is kind of obvious. But there's another kind called Sukha dukkha.
Discontent of pleasure?
Yes, the discontent of pleasure. Mm-hmm. And it's or related to the discontent of impermanence. So we might be totally happy, everything's just fine, but we know in the back of our mind it's impermanent, it's not going to last. So it's a type of suffering. And then the third type is the most subtle, and they say is the other two kind of come and go, but this third type for sentient beings is basically continuous, and it's the suffering of just being conditioned. The suffering that's just like being a conditioned being and not realizing our unconditioned Buddha nature. So that's quite a subtle one. You maybe don't even notice, but it's not quite right compared to the complete liberation. So shall we open it up to questions? Johnny.
Thank you, Father Cyprian. Thank you very much. You take me home in a way, since my roots are where you are. And as you were speaking, I was thinking of the doxology, especially the third term, Christ will come again. And I was thinking, when we chant quite often, we give homage to the Buddha, we include in that homage to Maitreya Buddha, future Buddha of loving kindness. I point out to my teacher that, future is just the next moment, so why do we look so far in advance? And to me, it's a practice, a very physical practice. We have six paramitas, I won't list them. Six things we do, we cultivate. And I'm wondering now, what is the current thinking about the second coming? And we were talking about coming and going. What is the role of the second coming, and does it have any relationship to the imminence of loving kindness?
To give you the orthodox answer would take me a long time, and I'd probably have to get a book and look it up again too. But can I just give you my take on it? instead?
I prefer that.
Okay. There's this very strange relationship to time that I'm kind of fascinated with also. And we did not give you a prize fight tonight. We agreed on everything, so maybe on this one we can disagree a little bit. For, it seems to me anyway, for the Asian mystical traditions, quite often time seems as a kind of an illusion or an irrelevant thing. But for the prophetic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, time is a sacramental thing. Time is going somewhere. And we believe, especially the Christian tradition, time is going somewhere good, to some kind of a fulfillment, to some kind of an end, whatever you want to call that end. And so one of the fascinating things about Sri Aurobindo of India, for instance, who I studied a lot because he was very influential and the teacher that I studied the most, is that he brought in a kind of an evolutionary concept into Indian thought. So it's to see that these are not necessarily antagonistic. They can somehow be complementary, but there's a movement in time. Does that is kind of a background, okay? And if we limit the term Christ to the historical person of Jesus and get a kind of a classic comic book version of Scripture, we might be doing a disservice to ourselves about the reality of where we actually think time is going in the broadest sense of the word. The Christ, as I understand it, is the fullness of being and somehow already exists and is pulling all things to it. So it's a, in the deepest sense, it's an already and not yet. And the whole of the Christ is not just the historical Jesus. The whole of the Christ is somehow all this creation being called to absolute union and perfection as well. So St. Paul has this tiny little phrase that somebody like Pierre de Chardin and other mystics will just go nuts over when he says, God will be all in all. And he says that's a kind of a Christian panentheism. The fact that nothing gets left behind, and it's somehow already there and not yet. There's a movement and a stasis both going on at the same time.
So we speak of ourselves as being the body of Christ.
Yes, and we don't mean that as a metaphor.
No, but if we practice things like generosity,
yes,
good conduct,
yes,
patience, enthusiastic effort, calmness, and wisdom, we are in fact shedding the physical body of Christ and resurrected.
Yeah, and it's already and not yet.
It's already and not yet.
It's already manifesting, and it's not fully manifest yet. There's this movement towards this full. This is what our hope is based on, the fact that this is going to continue to manifest.
To reveal fully what is already there.
Exactly.
Well, you're a good Buddhist.
And you're an anonymous Christian.
May I just add to this point about already and not yet?
Please.
Because I can't help thinking about, again, Buddha nature. Is that the teaching is that Buddha nature, like our own true, completely free and compassionate, selfless nature, is already here, completely imminent, lacking nothing, and yet it's obscured by our, basically our ideas and dualistic thinking and so on. So it's not like we're like trying to gradually like create a Buddha. Is Buddha already here, but we're not fully appreciating it. It's blocked. It's like the sun is always shining, but the clouds cover it sometimes.
No, can I just tag onto that for a second? Actually, our friend Ryan from Tassajara and I were having this conversation. In some way, let's say there's a great teacher who has realized, and she or he shows a method or a way to practice, but somehow that way is already the manifestation of the realization. It's like if you live like I live now as a realized being, you too will be a realized being. So in some way, the way already is the end. You're already there. The journey already is the thing. And in a moment then I understood this importance of shikantaza. It already is Buddha nature. Just to be practicing the way already is the end in some way.
One moment of just sitting is one moment of Buddha. And then we get up and get all confused again. Yes, Stan.
Father Shipping, I want to thank you for coming tonight. And I've been doing Zen practice for a long time, but I remember tonight for the first time in 50 years, I did my first monastic practice. I went to Middlebury College, and the nearest close monastery was Saint-Benoît du Lac, which is a French monastery in Quebec that I used to go to. And I remember really enjoying being in that tradition, which eventually led to Zen, and now here to you. And this community that we've been a part of only for 2 or 3 months, we just moved from Modesto here, and we love this Zen community, and even better now that it's interfaith. But a question for you both. How do you manifest your own grounded infinite being of goodness and get out of your own way to become better instruments of peace in each and every moment of your daily life? And then how do you get that? Just for daily practices, for lay practitioners like us, what do you do to keep you on the path and open and making appropriate responses? As much as you can.
Yeah.
From both.
Yeah, that's a big assumption. Ask my brothers.
How do you do it?
You might ask, what's our intention?
The daily practice is to keep you on.
Yeah.
This is where he plays guitar.
Okay, everybody tango. Do you want to go first?
Well, I could just say, Johnny already brought up the six paramitas is, I think, a really great, all kind of well-rounded, encompassing set of practices, which, again, are giving or generosity, ethical conduct. We have the Bodhisattva precepts, patience, endurance, especially not reacting to harm and anger coming at us, diligence or enthusiasm around all these other practices, meditative concentration and calming the mind in order to see more clearly, and then at the end, wisdom, which is basically the realization of emptiness. And so that last one is kind of infuses all the other ones with, like, so that there can be giving without even the thought that we're giving, for example, without the right hand knowing what the left hand's doing, and so on. So I think, and also as Cyprian said, like, when great beings are actually, here's the method, if you live like this, then that is it. I think this is a set of practices that if we're really, like, in line with these six perfections, paramitas, which is rare that we're completely in line, there's no end to these practices, right? But that is kind of like being Buddha. Also, we say with the Bodhisattva precepts, which are very similar to the Ten Commandments in terms of what they... We have ten precepts, very similar. When one's really living them in an almost like effortless way, which maybe takes some time, then we say that's like that's basically like the shape of Buddha's mind. It's just this harmless, beneficial activity that's naturally flowing forth. So we have these practices that, like, if we're doing them completely, they basically are awakening. But it's hard. It's an endless lifetime practice.
Yeah, I mean, I'll talk more from the effort rather than from the achievement. But, you know, in a very particular kind of way, I so many friends up at Mount Madonna, and I did my yoga teacher training there as well, and this one little phrase of Baba Haridas, you think it means nothing, and suddenly it means everything to me when he says, all of life is yoga. And I was living up in this area for a while, and I had a really just a glorious life, a little cabin in the woods, you know, and I had plenty of time to do this and do that and do the other thing, and I was, you know, struggled. But now I'm back living with the brothers, and the first couple of months were pretty chill too, but then they elected me prior. So my day quite often is not my own. And I keep thinking of Baba Haridas saying, all of life is yoga. And it used to mean for me before, when I go running, that's also yoga. When I practice the guitar, that's also part of my spiritual life. When I exercise in the gym, that's also part of my spiritual life. That was easy. But now, when Brother So-and-so wants to talk to me about the broken down truck, that's also yoga. When we're talking about the paving the high road and back or to put chip seal on it, if I really believe in non-duality, what's not holy about that? When I'm washing dishes with Father Robert today, every one of those plates is a prayer. And I like to tell people my favorite moment all day long is after evening meditation, I go and raise the shades on the window. It's my favorite moment of the day. And every time I do that, there's a little, I say a little prayer with it. But we were teasing about, you know, as soon as we get off the cushion, you know, then we lose it all. The whole point of the cushion is, I don't think the cushion is the end. The cushion is the means. If I can't be just this patient at the DMV, then this is really a waste of time. This was really a waste of time. Because for me, even though monasticism, anthropologically speaking, is a withdrawal from the world, even the withdrawal from the world is not an end. And I think my problem quite often with the spiritual traditions, and especially the monastic ones, is they've been anti-world. Yeah. And that's not Christianity. Right. God so loved the world. It's all about God loving, being in love with the world. And so all of this is about the monk going back to the world with bliss bestowing hands somehow. Yeah. So my practice is just that, to try to think of every darn thing as a prayer. Everything as a spiritual practice in some way. I don't know how well I'm doing it and how well I'll do it in 6 months, but that's what my practice is at this point. And thank God for the cushion, and thank God for the Buddhists who taught me how to breathe, and thank God for the yogis who taught me how to correct my posture, and thank God for the people who taught me how to use my prayer beads, because I can take that through the whole day. I can take the breath and my posture and my intention through the whole day in that way.
Wow, that's great. Thank you so much.
Do you sit on the cushion?
Yeah.
Each day?
At the monastery at New Kamadali, they have a wonderful chapel with zafus and a silent meditation time. Very beautiful to sit with you all there. And of course, as Supreme was speaking, I Zen is very kind of known for this like practice in everyday life. Like we say, you know, chop wood, carry water is the, you know, the sublime practice of the Buddhas. So very much about like normal everyday activity in the world done with the spirit of letting go.
Yeah, and in the Rule of St. Benedict, there's this one little line, it's these tiny little gems that pass by. He says, all the tools of the monastery should be treated like vessels for the altar. Wow.
Sounds like Dogen.
That's a wow right there. You know, the kitchen, the workshop, the bathroom, the recreation room, everything in the monastery should be treated like vessels for the altar.
Beautiful. Yeah. Rain.
This might sound a little off, but who came first, Jesus or Buddha? And did they know each other?
They're about 500 years apart.
It seems.
It seems.
In the human world. But maybe really, oh, maybe both beginningless, endless.
Yeah.
And I wonder how much, you know, there's all kinds of stories about Jesus going to India and so on. But I'm sure these, especially the monastic traditions, it seems like they probably influenced each other over the centuries quite a bit because there's so much similarity.
Yeah. Yes. Though, as our Father Bruno, who's the sage of New Kamaldoli, would say, in some way, the contemplative tradition is the minority report because Christianity is so extroverted focused. You know, it's kind of the hidden element. And you might want to say, even in the prophetic traditions in general, like Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the mystical, the contemplative tends to be the minority report, the real gift of the, I'm going to call it the prophetic, not to call it the West, is that extroverted, and that's its great gift. And perhaps the real gift of the East is the interiority and the examination of the interior, and that's a great gift. And I think what we're actually looking for, Father B talked about the marriage of East and West. So we're not trying to leave anything behind. We're trying to find those great gifts of both those traditions and to be able to go seamlessly from the two.
I think that Buddhism has a lot to learn from the Christian tradition about serving the world and community. Mm-hmm. We have a global Sangha program where we cook for a soup kitchen once a week and things like this, but that's a kind of small part. Mm-hmm. I think we can expand that kind of thing more.
I'm almost afraid to say what I have to say or ask, but Jesus, in his essence or his isness, as we Christians, and I'm not saying this is, I'm not making it a declarative thing, sort of a question. We believe, I think, that he's perfection coming into a body. But he also did react in anger and in despair. He acted in anger in the temple. And he acted in despair on the cross, and he wouldn't. And as I'm speaking, I'm thinking that Mike Marini would probably say, well, that's a mystery. And I would like to know your reflection on it, either one of you, or both of you.
I would think of it, first of all, in line with this story of D.T. Suzuki. I mean, these things are, it's not evil to have emotions. Uh-huh. Even in the monastic tradition, I'm thinking this is Evagrius, like 4th century Egyptian desert. He's considered the great psychoanalyst of the monastic tradition. He talked about patheia and apatheia. And patheia were the passions. And apatheia means passionlessness. And that sounds so dry, you know. But passion doesn't, it's a language event. Mm-hmm. Passion does not mean what we think it means. Passion for them meant disordered emotions. And we realize along the way that emotions are, I don't know how much, like half chemical and half psychological. And there's nothing evil about chemicals. There's nothing evil about sexual attraction. There's nothing evil about joy. There's nothing evil about those things. But what's a disordered emotion? And I think now we're in similar territory to this idea of clinging and, you know, bloated now term. And apatheia sounds like apathy, but it doesn't mean apathy. It means our passions, our emotions are ordered. They're in their right place. And I would not want to live a life without emotions.
It would be impossible anyway.
But that'd be like living life without feet. You know, I mean, why would we be made this way if they weren't meant to be somehow ordered and bring joy and even then be a path to perfection? Hmm.
Also, I think of, again, I don't know all the details of Jesus with the money changers and so on, but from my understanding of that story, it's expressing great emotion, and we might call it anger, but it's not a selfish anger, right? It's like he was into righteousness, and this is, how can you do this to my father's house? Mm. It was not coming from a like personal selfish place, right? It was like, well, truth must be revealed here. Mm. So I think there's that in bodhisattvas might get angry
at people who are causing harm. Mm-hmm. But I think there's anger that's like self-centered anger, and there's anger to benefit others. Mm-hmm. I think that was a skillful means, we might call in Buddhism, yeah. to benefit.
And some scholars will posit like an act like that could have been something like guerrilla theater, you know, really trying to provoke some kind of a reaction out of the wealthy priestly class that was oppressing the poor.
Thank you, Sidman, for coming. Your brother David is a dear friend of mine. We spent much time at Tassajara together. I'm someone who was raised Catholic, and I have Catholic roots in a Buddhist practice. And it seems to me like in the West, both of these great traditions have had to encounter and do something with the primacy of the ego. So there's this emphasis on the beyond the ego. And yet, in all my teachings of the Christian tradition, the Catholic Christian tradition, there was something about Jesus in his humanity that continued beyond death, that he was seen in a form that his friends recognized. He held a barbecue for his friends on the beach when he came back and so forth, when he was seen after his death. And in Buddhism, we talk to Suzuki Roshi, we talk to our ancestors and people who have passed on. So there's in terms of talking about emptiness and the emptiness of self, but then in what form does self continue if there is no self or no essence? I'd just be interested in hearing your thoughts on this, both of you.
Well, of course, this might be one of the divergences of traditions, where all spiritual traditions have some story about what happens after you die, right? So, and even within Buddhism, there's some different takes, but the story of rebirth, as long as there's fuel for coming back, either, you know, the classic story that in early Buddhism, it's like you're trying to end rebirth because this cycle is filled with discontent, dukkha. You want to end it, and basically like there's nothing left. Nirvana, pari nirvana, is like the fire's gone out completely. But then again, in the Mahayana, bodhisattva, compassion path, then the vow, they turn it again on its heels. We vow to keep coming back just in order to help others be free from the cycle. So I don't know if you know, particularly Christ's resurrection is almost like a rebirth, but it's also maybe more like merging with the ultimate.
Yeah, this might have something to do with time too. Again, this notion of time, cyclical as opposed to linear, there's actually an evolution to another state, in a sense, you know, according to the story. That's what's interesting about it. I think the whole idea of the transmigration of souls is one way of describing a phenomena that's really just so far, beyond our comprehension. But this idea, people laugh about something like purgatory that we have in the Catholic tradition, which I think is also a very beautiful explanation of this idea that whatever work hasn't been done, in the next realm there's actually still time, mm-hmm. there's still space. Mm-hmm. It's really an expression of great mercy to work this out and keep moving forward rather than coming back.
Almost like there is a rebirth into purgatory.
But it's like the only word I can use is realm somehow. Mm-hmm. And the word ego, it's interesting, it just gets used in so many different ways. Whatever that essence is, I mean, this really is foundational for us, even though Paul will say something like, I no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. That seems that the I is gone there, but actually it's I who's talking at that point. There's somehow this essence, and this is Teilhard's language again, the whole Christ is made up of all those essences together, union in communion in some beautiful way. You know, our friend Kabir Helminski has his beautiful writings about the ego. Even the ego somehow gets a bad name. That too is a function, like the emotions or the body. It's a beautiful thing with its own function to steer us beyond the ego. The whole point is going beyond it. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if we responded well to what...
Yeah, maybe not.
That's what you were talking
about. Yeah, the thing is, I just a tiny correction. Jesus' apostles did not recognize him. That was the interesting detail of the story. Mary Magdalene's talking to him, and she doesn't know who she's talking to until he calls her name. He's cooking breakfast with them on the beach. They don't know who it is until he feeds them. So that's the interesting thing about it. It's something, even though he's in the according to the story. And again, the details are interesting for what they're conveying, not for the historical scientific facts. That there's somehow... It's the same, but it's different. It is a whole, Jesus is somehow manifesting in a different realm, you might say.
In the back there?
That's it. Yes.
This is maybe a little bit more on a practical level, but I was just thinking of suffering in terms of someone causing harm to another living being or causing something that create separation within oneself. In the Catholic tradition, there's the sacrament of reconciliation. Mm-hmm. You go to the priest and express what's happened in your life, and there are opportunities and an interchange too. It's more of a dialogue too, but a way of becoming more at peace, kind of washing yourself clean. And maybe Supreme can speak a little bit more to that, but also in the Buddhist tradition, is there a counterpart for reconciliation in that way?
Yeah, great question, because I think we all of these key things, all these traditions need all of these things, right? So we have repentance is a term we sometimes use. So, and sometimes we do it one-on-one with a priest, or like in one-on-one practice discussion, people can bring up things and release them like that. Other things can also happen in the practice discussion, other practice points. But we also have the, every morning in our service, we begin with a repentance verse, and it's more a communal thing and internal, like we say, all my ancient twisted karma, which is, you know, all my past harmful actions, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow, and avow is sometimes translated as repent or confess, acknowledge that I'm human and I have caused harm. And we do this, so we do that every day. And then internally we can think, oh yeah, since the last time I did this, these are the things I've done. We don't necessarily tell anyone, it's more internal, although we could. And then we also have... on the full moon, this goes back to the Buddha's time, once a month on the full moon, we have a precepts renewal ceremony where we start with that verse and then we kind of recommit to these bodhisattva precepts of non-harm as a community. And in some Buddhist traditions, at that full moon ceremony, they get together in pairs and, you know, not so much like they're going to one person, but just the monks all divide up and confess to each other the harm they've done since the last full moon. We don't necessarily do that. We do more like as a group thing. But a very important principle, reconciliation and coming together again.
Yes. I have some stories I wish I could tell about this. How many non-Catholics and even non-Christians have come to me for confession? And every now and then, I don't even know that until it's all over. Actually, the first confession, one of the first confessions I heard after I was ordained a priest, this woman came to me. Long confession was very beautiful. We were both in tears at the end of it. And we're sitting at lunch afterwards. And she says to one of the young monks, with whom I was not getting along very well, she says, "Oh, Father Cyprian's my confessor, and I'm not even Catholic." Oh, so that's why you didn't know how to say the Confiteor. Okay, right. one of the beautiful things about that is people think of the, I'm also ordained priest, so what people think of the priest as the representative of God in Christ, but the priest is also the representative of the church, in persona Christi, in persona Ecclesiae. So to confess, in some way you're confessing to the body that way. The priest represents all of humanity in that way too. So taking that on. And I think it's psychologically so good for us to say these things out loud and to acknowledge them in that way. And the Russian Orthodox tradition had a practice of confessing to the earth itself. Thomas Spidlik writes about this, this great Eastern Christian author, confessing to the earth itself, which is quite, quite beautiful. And I have to say, this line that Kokyo just said, I think of it all the time in the confessional, twisted karma. Because we're supposed to then give a penance to the person who confesses to us. And it's, you know, the forgiveness is not dependent on whether you did that penance or not. But what I'm always trying to think when I offer the penance is, now what can I offer to this person to undo the twisted karma, to do something opposite, to move against it? Because that's the whole point of that, you know, the reparative, the restorative aspect of reconciliation. It's not enough to say, for me, it's not enough to say, I'm sorry, you're forgiven. It's like, now do something about it. Undo it.
Yeah, which may be like a practical thing of going to talk to someone we've harmed.
Yeah.
But Buddhism also has practices, like right after that verse in the morning, then we say, I take refuge in Buddha and the Buddha's teachings and the Sangha practitioners. That's in a way a positive response. I come back into alignment. And then there's also, we don't do so much here, but there's Buddhist practices of like doing prostrations or some kind of positive activity to kind of undo it. Because I think, yeah, psychologically, it really, to confess and repent and do something positive to balance out is so healing. It really changes our being. I see we're about time.
Yeah.
So this could go on, you know, all night. Shall we end with a song?
Yes.
For those from the Zen Center, Cyprian is an amazing musician, as you're about to hear. Has many CDs of spiritual music from around the world. And this one song that I think he's going to play, Compassionate and Wise,
yeah,
or sometimes called Dedication of Merit. Was it written by Hongshir?
The melody is Lorena McKennett, but he put the words of the Metta Sutta onto it when he was part of a Buddhist Christian gathering the week of the terrorist attacks in 2001 at a Benedictine monastery.
Great interfaith song.
Thank you. time reward. May all the sorrow leave their grief and pain. May this promised light dispel the darkness of their endless night. Because our hearts are one, this world of pain turns into paradise. May all become compassionate and wise. May all become compassionate and wise. May all become compassionate and wise. May all become compassionate and wise.
Thank you so much. Thanks everybody for coming tonight. What a great luminous house this is.
May the conversation stay alive endlessly. Practice and support each other to do this difficult and necessary work endlessly.